Welcome to the Fatherhood is Lit podcast, where we talk about the best of times, but also pay respect and learn from the crazier times. Our presence matters. Take a ride with us as we show the world how we make our presence felt. Fatherhood is Lit. What's good, Fatherhood? Growing up, my dad taught me to always do me. I was that kid that was too cool for the nerds, but was also too nerdy for the cool kids. I felt alone, but made it through. Today's guest probably had to deal with the same thing many of us did, not fitting in at all times. I am honored to have Kenneth Kellogg on today's episode. What's up, Kenneth?
What's up, man? How you doing?
How you doing, man? You know, I had to have you on here, man. I saw you speak at Dad 2.0. And you killed it, by the way. You were on that stage.
Appreciate it, man.
You rocked it. And when I heard your story. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I hate public speaking, man. Like, I'm not a fan of it. But when you have a story to tell, it's just easy. It's easy. You know, it just kind of falls out. So,
yeah.
It was an honor to be there and speak, you know, to all those dads.
Oh, you killed it, man. And your story spoke volumes, man. And that's the reason wanted you here, because you're an opera singer, bro.
You sing,
and you don't just sing opera for fun. You do this as a profession. And where I'm from, as we were speaking before, where I'm from, you know, you either had sports or you had the corner. I was a nerd, and I had all my friends looking at me funny because I would rock out on my computer when computers were just starting out, you know, AOL 5.0 with the dial up and all that good stuff. But I would have Jordans on, and I would be out there with my skateboard or my rollerblades. Doing hood shit, man. You know,
it's funny, you know, beating people up. We kind of skated both of those roads. You know, I had a foot in the streets with all my friends, but then I had this other side that I couldn't really be myself with my friends.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, they knew it, and they fully accepted me for it. But yeah, it is kind of, you know, toting that line of where you're from and, you know, where you see your life going.
Yeah, and I think that's the reason I wanted you here, because I think a lot of us sometimes we have to make choices that our friends don't agree with, as to where we want to go with our lives or our lifestyle.
Of course.
And this is a lesson for our kids. Like, you know, you could do you. So
yeah.
Let's start with that, man. Well, how was your background growing up, man? Were you listening to opera while listening to Biggie or what? Like, how was this?
No,
how
man,
did this play out?
I still don't really listen to opera.
What?
I love singing opera. I still don't really listen to it.
Liar. But, you serious?
I mean, I grew up in D.C. I mean, Go-Go was huge.
Yeah.
I listened to Go-Go. I listened to all the hip-hop.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm a singer, though. Like, because I'm a singer, you know, Bone Thugs and Harmony, when they came out, was, like, the shit.
Oh, yeah. Classic.
So actually singing and rapping. So they really struck a chord with me when they first came out. But, you know, Nas, Biggie, Jay-Z.
Oh, so you were in the golden era.
I listened to.
You were in the golden era, bro.
Of course, man.
Nas, Biggie, come on.
You know, honestly, I can't listen to hip-hop now. Like, I don't even listen to hip-hop now because it doesn't speak to me the way that music did when I was growing up.
Yeah, yeah. I'm with you. Like, I'm more of a beat guy, so I can listen to the new beat. Sometimes some of the hooks are, like, catchy, but I leave that to my kids, man. Like, you know, all the slang and all that. Like, man, I'll get it all confused because I'll hit them with the 80s and 90s and they'll look at me like, what, Dad? Like, what are you saying?
Right, of course.
So what led you to Oprah?
There's a couple cats I listen to now. Like, Big Sean I can listen to. Drake
I love
every
Big
now
Sean.
And then. There has to be some substance to the music, which gets me.
So you're an opera singer that listens to hip-hop, bro?
Of course.
I think we're done.
A lot of opera singers who
listen to hip-hop. Like, you killed all misconceptions. I think you killed all misconceptions right there.
Yeah, of course.
So what led you to it? Like, did somebody, like, were you in school and did you hear something that you said, yo, I want to sing and I want to pick this genre? Or, like, was there somebody in the background?
I mean, I always loved singing. I loved the expression of singing growing up. I was a quiet kid, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So when people would listen to me sing and they'd have a reaction, I was like, oh, all right. And like, I'm quiet, but I have a voice. I've been given this gift to do something with. And I had amazing teachers growing up, and music was big in public schools then. And then, you know, I there was a teacher that I really attached on to and I really loved, with my music teacher in elementary school. And she kind of, you know, just one of those people who just spoon fed music to me, man. And it kind of grew into this passion, which then grew into a career. And it was always just fun for me to sing, and, you know, making music with people is such a collaborative thing. And there's a spirit when it comes to making music you just can't get anywhere else. So I attached on to that before I really knew what I was doing in music and opera, you know. And I was in my first opera before I actually saw my first opera.
Wait, you were in because, your first one performing before you actually went to one? Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't one of those things I grew up with. You know, I grew up, you know, my household, you had Motown, you had hip-hop, you had Big Daddy Kane. Like, you had, you know, this American music. You know, opera just wasn't a part of my upbringing. And then I got to high school. I went to Performing Arts High School in Washington, D.C., Duke Ellington School of Performing Arts. And I was introduced to singing there. But still, it wasn't, you know, I mean, it was classical singing, but I'd never seen a full-on opera. And I somehow managed to get a scholarship to go to college for singing.
What?
And I majored in music. And, you know, somebody agreed to pay for it. So I was like, all right, bet.
Why not?
I was going to major in something else. But if you're going to pay me to sing, you know, you can pay for me to go to school for singing, then I'm definitely going to take that opportunity. And I think that's kind of happened. You know, I listened to, you know, people who knew more than I did. And, you know, I respected these people and respected the lives that they lived. And, you know, I trusted the guidance. And it kind of led me down a path that led me into a career into music.
What made you choose to listen to them? Because I know, you know, coming from the South Bronx, you know, we have a lot of, like, from where I was from, we had a lot of pulls. You know, we had the street kids telling you things, you know, their OGs telling you things, the parents telling you things. Like, what lets you say, let me take that maturity and listen to others because they might know more than me? Like, what ticked in your brain? Like, what was that? What set that off? Because that's hard for people to do sometimes.
It's hard, but, like, I mean, I remember clearly as a young person seeing, you know, cause and effect. Mm-hmm. I knew what was happening in the neighborhood. I knew what was happening in families where I grew up.
Yeah.
A lot of my, you know, I walk down the street and see addicts, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I had family members who sold drugs, and I had, you know, I had to deal with guns, you know, I had to deal with all this stuff, and I knew that wasn't the way life should have been. Mm-hmm. You know, I was clearly able to see that this was a set of consequences. The consequences of these actions are going to lead to a life that I don't particularly want.
Yeah.
And, you know, in school, you know, I was dealing with, you know, responsible, quote unquote, responsible adults who lived a different life. And it was something that wasn't a part of my everyday, but I saw the joy and the happiness that it created in their lives. So it made me curious, you know, like, what are they doing different than that's what's happening in my neighborhood? And the more I latched onto those people, I was able to see, you know, the possibilities of just making different choices.
Yeah. Did you ever look at them and say, you know, the routes that you guys are choosing, that could never be me? Like, I just don't have it in me to do it. Or did you just say from the get, I want better, whatever it's going to take, I'm going to do.
You know, it's funny because I didn't see a problem with, you know, the things that I saw growing up. Mm-hmm. I mean, because it's how I grew up, you know, like, it wasn't a problem for me. It just was.
It was part of life. Yeah.
But it was part of life. You know, I saw people, you know, going in and out of prison. You know, I saw, you know, addicts having been rushed to the hospital. You know, as a kid, it's like, okay, like, that's happening. Like, I knew what was wrong on some level. Like, why? I mean, I couldn't fully comprehend. But I saw, you know, a whole other set of people that were in my life not having to deal with these things. I was like, if I don't have to deal with those things on a daily basis, I don't want to.
Yeah. You're a victim of circumstance.
Yeah, totally. Totally a victim of circumstance. And I was able to make some choices, you know, based on seeing circumstance and seeing cause and effect.
Yeah. Yeah, because I get that a lot. Like, people ask me all the time. They're like, man, how did you make it out? And for me, my dad had me seeing people using drugs. Like, he didn't use it. He didn't sell it. But he had me in front of friends that did use it, did sell it. And he was smacking me across the head and tell me, look at that guy doing it. Look what's going to happen after.
Oh,
and that was a wake-up call.
I had my family doing it. I had my family out selling drugs.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, you know, I'm doing it, but you don't have to. And I think that, you know, on some level that saved me, you know, because the things that pulled them into the drug game was, you know, not having, you know, my parents not being able to afford that fast life and then working a normal, like, my mom was a workhorse. You know, she worked for the government for a lot of her life. And there were certain things that she couldn't afford. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my older cousins, you know, they saw this fast life that was in the streets. and it was attractive to them, and they went for it, you know. Mm. But when I was growing up, you know, they lived this life that kind of afforded me things, you know. I mean, drug money kind of saved my life, oddly enough.
Yeah.
I tell this story, and I've actually had to thank my cousin at some point. I was like, you know, thank you for making some sacrifices, horrible sacrifices, but you lived a life that, you know, has treated you horribly, but it kind of saved my life, you know, because you made some bad choices, you were able to make some good choices in your life that kind of saved my life and put me in a different trajectory, because I didn't have to go out and chase the fast money, because they, you know, they kind of, you know, took care of me. And they knew what they were doing was wrong, but it's an odd thing. It's an odd thing to explain, but
no, I agree.
If you live that existence, like, you know, it's hard to explain to someone who doesn't know, but if you live it every day, like, you understand it.
Yeah, no, I agree. Because I think that when I got married, my wife is, she's half Chinese, half Puerto Rican, and she was raised with the Chinese side, which is very, very traditional. And one of my cousins-in-law was the Bronx DA, Bronx assistant DA. And the first day she met me, she was like, oh, you hang out with all those bad kids. And it was like, oh, you really don't know where I come from. Like, yeah, you're right. Right. You're right. I hang out with some badass kids. Yeah. But you don't know why they do the things that they do. But me being in it, I could see it differently. I could see why they had to do these things. That doesn't mean that I'm going to do it.
Absolutely.
So I totally agree with you, and I understand, because that's something my dad taught me. Like, my dad from the beginning, he had me on the corner seeing everything happen, but then he also reminded me that the world is bigger than the stop sign, meaning that of corner course. Where the stop sign is at, if you want to stay there, that's on you. Once you cross the street, you're in the real world. Now it becomes bigger.
Yep.
So how do you, now that you know those things, how do you keep your kids, or how do you plan on teaching your kids not to get attracted by nonsense? That's a tough one. I know that's a tough one.
And that's a tough one, but not really. You know, I think one of the things that draws people to the streets is not having opportunity, you know, and thinking that there's a better life out there. So I think by, you know, affording my kids just the opportunity to see the world, you know, to see the world and different through a different lens will keep them from that lifestyle, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you have to appreciate those people on the corners. I mean, they are bad people. You know, they're a product of circumstance. I understand every single one of them. I understand addicts. I understand dealers. They're out there for a reason, and it's not their own all the time. So I don't look down on those in those situations.
Mm-hmm. That's
right. But I know it's not a life that I want my kid to live, and I don't live myself. I'm able to make different choices because I put myself in different circumstances.
Yeah, no, that's real. That's real talk, because I think that's something that's difficult for many dads to separate, right? Where it was like, we, you know, like, I don't want to shield my kid, right? I want to shield him. I want to shield my sons. I want to keep them safe. I want to give them the white picket fence, but I also want them to know what the corner looks like.
And we're all one choice away. You know, we're all one choice away from being in that circumstance.
Yep. Literally, one bad day. One bad day can change it all.
One bad day. Of course.
But you only understand that when you live that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you've always been sheltered and had everything at your disposal, you don't understand what it feels like to be at the bottom or near it. So it's hard. And that's something that I tell my kids, where it's like, my oldest, I tell him all the time, damn, dude, you spoiled. Like, you're complaining about your iPhone.
Yeah, yeah.
I had to complain to my mother not to pick up the phone because she would knock me off the internet.
Right, of course.
And people look at me and they're like, man, you're tough. And it's like, no, I got to remind them, like, man, dude, you got it good. You got it good. Yeah. And because you got it good, I expect good from you. I expect greatness. You can't go backwards.
Of course.
Can't go backwards. You know?
Yeah.
So now you get to college, you start learning about music. So what drew you to opera there? Was it like an opera class, or just the allure of doing something different and showing your friends that, yo, I'm the man?
I mean, partially that, you know, being from the hood and being the only one really from your neighborhood to do something and being successful at it, you know, carries a certain level of street cred, you know?
Oh, hell yeah.
But it's a different street cred.
It's the real stripes, though. It's the real stripes.
Yeah, of course. I mean, they'll talk about you. They'll make fun of you. But under that, you can see the level of respect that they have, you know? Yeah. And even going back to that corner, you can see the pride in their eyes that someone from their neighborhood made a different choice. You know,
I
go back to my neighborhood in D.C. and, you know, I still see some of these same guys like on the corner. You know, some of the same winos that were out when I was a kid are still out there doing the same exact thing. But, you know, we lock eyes and I approach them with the respect that they deserve as human beings. And you can see just the pride that wells up in them for what you've accomplished coming from where they've come from. I mean, it's a mutual respect.
That's crazy. You know what's crazy about that, man? Like, I think the craziest part about that is explaining it to your kids. Like, I don't know how to explain that to my son. Like, dad ran the streets. The nerds were scared of him, but then the street dudes weren't scared of him because he was a nerd himself. And I think that's so confusing for my son, where he's like, damn, dad, like, you're a tough dude, but you're a nerd, man. Like, you love computers. Like, what's going on? And it's like, you know, it just takes time.
Though, man, that is human. You know, we're like, there's so many facets to people. You know, when we try to put people in those boxes and define them as one thing, it gets very confusing.
And
so when you allow them to be everything they can possibly be, I can sing opera and still go ball, you know?
Yeah, yeah. You can still,
can,
it's still
I
you.
I can sing opera can and put on the boxing gloves and still knock somebody out. You know?
And remind them where you came from.
Of course. Of course. We have to respect the totality of people, man.
Yeah,
we're all capable of everything.
And I think that's a funny part from the hood, too, where people could judge you and laugh at what you do, but underlying it, like, they still respect it. Like, you're right. Like, when I go back to my hood, they're all like, yo, Jimmy made it. Like, he was always a nerd, but he stuck to it. You know what I mean? And it's like, yo, like, you feel that respect. And I think that I love it more when my son is there. When my son is there and now my friends are able to tell him, yo, that's your dad? Like, your dad was on Good Morning America talking about fatherhood? Oh, you don't know. Yeah, you don't know the James I know.
Of course. You know, whenever I go back to D.C. to do an opera, you know, like, all my friends, they want to come. And I tell them, like, don't dress up, man. Like, because they have this perception they have to dress up to come to the opera.
They want to throw in a suit.
Come as yourself, man. And I was doing a competition once in Annapolis. Mm-hmm. And I told my boys, and like, I'm singing opera at this competition. Man, they showed up high as hell. Like, they were high. But I loved it, you know.
You
like,
were still proud, bro. You're still proud.
It was them, you know, in their, like, it was them. Like, I knew I was on stage singing and I could smell it, but I knew it was them.
Oh, that is hilarious.
And I was proud that they, you know, they were proud enough to come as themselves in that situation.
Yo, I love it though. I love it. That goes back to what we're talking about, like doing you. Like,
of course.
I remember one time I interviewed a guy named Ben Horowitz, who's a big tech billionaire, you know, VC guy, and we were talking about hip hop, and that was the same thing, man. We had 100 people in the room, and I knew exactly where my friends were sitting. Like, I could tell, but they were also the first ones to jump up and clap for me. The minute I jumped on stage and said, hey, you know, we're here to represent, we're going to interview such and such, they up there, yo, James. I wasn't embarrassed. Inside, I'm like, yo, guys, calm down a little bit.
No,
but it was good to see.
You can't be embarrassed.
Yeah, it was good to see. So now, did you ever have any friends that told you, what the hell are you doing joining opera? And what did you tell them?
No one ever told me not to do it. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of misconceptions about what I was doing, you know, like, oh, like, dude, like, when you put out a video, I'm going to be in the video. I was like, we don't really make opera videos.
We hitting the block, man. We hitting the block. That's it.
Of course. There was never any naysayers, but there was always an appreciation without a clear understanding, especially early in my career. There was appreciation without a clear understanding of what I was doing, but I always had, you know, their full support. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they kind of use it to their advantage, you know. We go to a club and we go to a party. It's like, no, Jay, come here, come sing to this girl. And then, like, literally, I would sing to girls in the club.
You're an asset.
Like, sing some opera verse. I'm an asset in the club, you know. Like, yo, like, my boy sing opera. Come listen to him. And literally, we would go home with chicks from the club because I, you know, sing a couple verses in the club in their ear.
Oh, man, you were that guy, huh? They were using you.
I was that guy. Hey,
you got to leverage everything. Yo, the streets and the hood will teach you. You got to leverage everything. There's no shame in that,
everything,
man. You leverage every piece of you.
Man.
And that's a huge lesson for our kids, where it's like, yo, you got to leverage everything you have at your disposal. Because the world is unforgiving.
It's an asset.
Yeah.
It really is an asset, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So now they're at the shows rocking out with you. And then when you graduated college, did you jump into a full career in opera? Or was it like slow and steady?
I mean, I was able to travel quite a bit singing opera. I mean, starting out with any career, you start at lower level and you work your way up.
Yeah.
But I moved back to D.C. actually and joined a couple programs there. I did my training at Washington National Opera.
Nice.
I moved out to San Francisco and I did some training in San Francisco. So I moved all the country training as an opera singer. Mm-hmm. And I got to travel, I got to travel the world. You know, I take my family with me. Whenever I go in the world, I take my family with me just to get that experience.
So that's dope. That's exposure.
Experiencing the world as an opera singer, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I love that because that's real exposure right there. Now they actually don't get to question what you do. They get to see it.
Of course. You know, my son was with me in an opera. Like, I had an opera written for me 2 years ago. My son got to be with me on stage.
What?
It was one of the most fulfilling experiences in my entire career.
Wait a minute. Yeah, wait a minute. You know the podcast is called Fatherhood is Lit, right? So that had to be one of those crazy moments, bro. Like, Who did you call after your son did that? Like, did you call your mom? Like, who did you call and say, yo, I can't believe my son was with me on this? Because that's incredible.
It was a crazy experience because, I mean, I knew this, the producer, contacted me about this opera. They wanted to write it specifically for me. And the opera was about, a father and his relationship with his family and his son being, one of those most important relationships. Mm-hmm. And they needed a toddler, to play my son. And normally they hire, they hire a kid as an extra. But the director was like, you have a son. We can't get any more authentic than that.
Yeah.
How would you feel if your son was in the show? So, I mean, being in show business, there's a certain level of, do I really want my son to go toward this life? So I talked to my wife about it, and we both agreed that it would be a great experience for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he literally was like, all right, let's sign him up. He got a contract. I negotiated his contract.
What? He was a child performer contract, man? You got the child performer license and all that?
Yeah. I had to do all that. I had to set up the Coogan account. He got a trust account.
Yeah. They take their percentage.
Of course.
That's incredible.
So, yeah, I mean, we did all of that. But, just to be on stage with him and get to, see, something I've dedicated my life to and get to share that with my son on stage was just, it's one of those experiences I'll never forget and I'll always cherish. Seeing him, in the rehearsal room, like giving notes to the director at 4 years old, It's like, what? You can't, this is your first time in the room. You can't be talking to the director like that.
But he was a boss.
He went in as his authentic self. He went as himself. And I was proud because I could see, the courage that I tried to instill in him as a kid and that pride and just in his confidence and his abilities, just being himself in the room was all on display in this show. And I cried almost every rehearsal.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask you. How did you go? Because I think one of those days I would have been in the dressing room crying, man, like just to be proud. You know what I mean?
We shared a dressing room. Like, this is crazy. We shared a dressing room. Like, he was my son, but he was also my colleague in that moment,
That's
so I literally had, had to help him get in costume. I had to help him, run over his stagings. And so when you're in the show, you have a kid in the show. They have this thing called child minders. You have someone come in to watch the kids. So there was someone in the room specifically watching him. As he was a colleague, and I'm his dad sitting in the next chair getting makeup for a show, So it was a surreal experience, one that I hope to get.
How did you separate the two? Like, how did you not become his real dad during the performance? Like how did you keep it business? Right? Because I think like if my son is in the room with somebody and they tell him something that maybe I don't like, I'm reverting back to fatherhood.
Of course.
So how difficult was it to keep in line?
Yeah. I mean, as a dad, you establish those boundaries with the director or you establish those boundaries with whoever's in charge of the room. Like, this is my son and nothing's going to happen with my son that I don't agree with. So you establish that boundary with the director or the person in charge without ever, addressing it with your son.
Mm-hmm.
And then you sit back with that understanding that, your child is at some point going to have to go out into the world and be his own man. So even at 5 years old, you give him leeway to, you know, fail and to discover some things on his own with his five-year-old understanding, as long as you understand that the environment is safe. I was able to step back and allow him to discover some things on his own. And when, you know, I saw some things that, you know, he was doing that wasn't safe, you know, like running too close to the edge of the stage, you know, those father instincts kicked in. Mm-hmm. But I always tried to step back and allow him to discover his own space and own boundaries.
Yeah, I love it.
Within that five-year-old understanding.
It seems like you kept it, you mixed both, but you knew when to like take a stand and when not to. Right? Like,
of course. Yeah.
Yeah, so go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, so, and that's parenting though, you know, like the older your kids get, you realize that, you know, their boundaries can expand.
That's a good one.
And you step back every day. Like, every day the distance gets a little greater until you fully trust them to make some decisions and discover some things, and the consequences of failure aren't that great. You know, you discover how far you can step back and let them suffer the consequences of some choices that they may make that may be detrimental to them.
That's hard. That's hard sometimes because some, you know, a lot of people like to be like helicopter parents, right? So how real do you keep it with your kids? Like how far do you let them fail before you jump in?
Of course. I weigh the consequence. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, as a parent, you always foreseeing consequences before they happen.
Yep.
If it's a matter of him, you know, falling down and get a scrape on his knee, if I keep telling him, Jaden, like, watch this because, you know, you may fall. If I tell him four times and he feels like he still wants to do it, like, all right, you know, you can deal with the consequences. It may be, you know, a scrape on the knee. Like, that's something you can handle at 5 years old.
Yeah.
But if I see that, you know, the consequences of you doing something is going to cause some consequences that I know you can't handle at 5 years, but you don't know that you can't handle at 5 years, then I'll step in. And like, this is a boundary that I know is too far for you. And I try to trust him, you know, especially when it comes to physical things. You know, kids know how far they can go, and you know, they have this instinctual fight or flight response. So you let them test. Like, skateboarding is a big thing now for my son. And he wants to go to the skate park and go up and down ramps. And the first day I was like, nah, kid, like, it's not happening.
You're not doing the half pipe for him?
Not at all.
What about you? You're doing it for him? You're jumping on the skateboard and doing the half pipe?
No. when COVID started, I went and bought skateboards. He already had one. So I went and bought one for myself so we can, you know, try to learn how to ride together. But he's surpassed me by now.
Mm-hmm.
But we went to the skate park, you know, 2 weeks ago. And there was some skaters out, and he so wanted to get on the ramp. And I was like my dad instinct was like, no, like, there's no way, you know. But then, you know, you see the want in his eyes, and he has to try, you know. If he never tries, then he's never going to succeed. Like, all right, you know, let's go to this part of the ramp. You can do this. You can do these tricks. You can go this far. So I set some boundaries for him to explore. And after he mastered those things, like, all right, we can go to this part after you've mastered that part. And now he's dropping in. At 5 years old, he's dropping in at skate park.
I think that's dope though, because for me, when I started learning how to skateboard, my dad paid for everything. He's paid for the equipment, you know, the skateboard, the guards, the shin guards, all of that. But he never saw me actually do it. So I think if he saw me do it, I think he would be cringing. I think he would turn his back, like, oh my God, I can't believe Jimmy's up there. You know what I mean?
It's hard, man. It's hard.
Yeah, it's really hard. It's really hard. I do that with my sons now. When I look at them, I'm like, oh my God, I got to turn my head.
Man, I foresee consequences like two and three steps ahead. Man, it's like, oh, if you run too fast down that hill, you might fall and bust your face open. These are things that are happening in the back of my head, but I don't express them to him because I don't want to instill that, you know, that fear in him. Like, I want him to go and explore as much as he can without my own fears getting in the way.
I love that. You know, I was going to ask you, how do you encourage your kid to follow along your footsteps? Maybe not as an opera singer, but going out the norm, right? Like, doing something that isn't normal to you. And I think you said it right there. It's the exposure. The exposure and then the willingness to see how it goes. If it doesn't go well, then we back up. If it goes well, then we continue, you know? And I think that's huge. And that's something that we don't teach our kids enough. You know, like I've seen parents that will actually tell their kids, hey, you know, you ride your bike, you fall, you're not riding it again. And to me, it's like, no, you ride your bike, you fall, you could keep going. But if you come to me crying, we're going to have an issue. Like, go back and do it. You know, bleed, do whatever you got to do. And I think that goes for both, you know, males and females. Like, we can't just baby them. You know what I mean?
I've accepted, I mean, like, I was a perfectionist growing up as a kid. So if there was something I tried, and I wasn't good at, then I would either keep trying or I would quit. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot of things that I wish I hadn't quit. And it wasn't until I got a little bit older that I had to learn to accept failure and embrace the work.
Yeah, I think that's
which I try to.
I think that's like, it's hard for all of us. Because I think for,
like,
I want to push my kids, but, you know, I want to embrace their failures and their successes. But I think sometimes we overstep where it's like, you should go do this because I said so, instead of you should go do this because you want to try it. I fell victim to that. Like, I had my son on a what's that thing called? One of those lines, zip lines. And we did a really big zip line before. And then the following year, we did a smaller one, like a 3-story one at a park. And my son was afraid to do it. And I really, really wanted to push him off the ledge. I was mean to him. I said some things I shouldn't have said. Then I jumped off the ledge by myself, thinking to myself, hey, he might do it too. Nah, he walked right down the stairs. And I needed wife to tell me to chill.
You have to respect that, though. I mean, it's difficult because as their parents, I wrote a Facebook post about this the other day. As parents, like, we think ourselves the teacher all the time. And we're trying to instill, but we're learning every day. Like, I learn every day from my son something new that he's discovering that my old eyes or my jaded eyes or my experienced eyes can't see. Because I don't have that youthful perspective. And I was was talking to my friends the other day. I mean, because my son's into skateboarding now, and he's doing these things that, like, as a 41-year-old man, it's like, there's no way I'm doing it. But I was talking to some of my friends, and it's like, man, we used to do things without fear. Like, we used to do all of these, you know, skateboarding down the middle of the street, cars coming, not caring, you know?
Yep.
We used to do these things as kids because we didn't have this. We didn't have these consequences instilled in us. We hadn't learned the consequences of actions. But I dare say I was freer as a kid. I was more adventurous as a kid than I am as a man. Because now I know the cost of making a mistake.
You don't want to fail it the next day.
Of course.
That's what I tell my friends now with like partying. Like, I'm 40 years old now. I haven't partied with my friends probably since like my early 30s. And they'll be like, hey, you know, we're going to all meet up. Let's go have a drink. I'm like, nah, man, I'm good. I don't want to wake up with a hangover tomorrow, man. I'm good. And they're like, man, you used to do this all the time. It's like, nah, I'm good. I'm good.
Yeah, of course.
Staying away.
I had this experience. I texted my friend. Like, I thought it was so funny, man. Like, I have 3 kids now. And my wife, it was the first time I had the house to myself. Like, my wife went out. She took the kids. It was the first time I had my wife. The house to myself in a long time. And normally, like, if I have the house to myself, I'm kicking back, I'm like, you know, throwing down a beer, I'm calling my friends, I'm like, let's do something. I'm alone. The first thing I did was clean the house, put up toys, and then I sat on the couch and did nothing. And that's all I wanted to do.
And it was relaxing.
And it was relaxing, you know? I'm old. Like, I just want to clean the house and relax.
It's crazy because it's like I've had that many times when I have like a 2-day vacation. I call it a vacation away from the family. It'll be like 2 days away from them. And it's like, man, I got so many plans. And I'll just lay down and do... Like, I'll do some dad stuff, which is the cleaning, you know, putting things away. But the most part, I'm just chilling. But there's also times when I have those 2 or 3 days and I miss them, man. Like, it's like, man, I could do anything I want right now. And all I want to do is FaceTime my son.
Yeah, I hear you.
And it's like, man, 18-year-old James would smack you across the head and tell you, yo, go have some fun.
Right.
It's like,
priorities have definitely changed.
Priorities are different, and it's like I tell my friends and my in-laws, like, where I came from, I'm happy to make it to 40. Like, most of my friends didn't make it to 17, 18. So, as horrible as it sounds, I kind of lived my life. Like, I'm doing things to better my life and continue to better it. But now I'm just focused on my kids. Like, I'm trying to give them everything that I had and more. And it's like, my life is done. Like, it sucks to say because I'm still doing some really cool things without them. But in reality, what I want to do is for them. You know, and it's kind of crazy because we need that time away. We need that time for ourselves to recharge and just get our heads back, you know, get our heads straight for the moment. But I totally agree.
Yeah. And I think for me, my kids they enrich my life.
Yeah.
My life definitely isn't over. I mean, we still have a lot of life to live. But I think my role as a dad now is the more I expand my world, the more their world is expanded.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
The more I learn, the more they can learn. The more I experience, the more I gain, the more I can give to them. So I tell my wife, like, while I'm not living solely for myself anymore, like, I enjoy the choices I make. I enjoy what I do. I enjoy traveling. I enjoy all of these things. But a lot of it is, you know, so I can bring that joy back to my family, or, you know, have them come to, like, we were just in Poland last year, you know. Like, my son's been to Poland, Spain, Switzerland. Like, he's been all over the world.
Incredible.
And I want that for him, you know. I want that for my family.
Now, how do you go back later on when your kids are older? And how do you think you're going to approach teaching them that everything that they did going on these various trips isn't necessarily the norm? So be thankful for it. Like, how do you do that? Because I think with my son, my oldest now, he's about to be 14. He's starting to understand a little bit more about like leveraging and you know, and clout, right? So when we do certain things, he does it differently than other kids. Meaning that when we go to Disney, you know, we're not waiting on lines. We have partnerships in place. You know, we're meeting basketball players, things like that. And sometimes I got to look back and remind him, you got it good. Like, this isn't the norm. And my wife will look at me and say, man, you shouldn't compare what you do with somebody else's. And I tell her, no, I have to, because I have to remind him that not everybody gets this luxury. And you're not only getting this luxury now, you might get it forever, but it's because of us. You didn't go fight for that. Now you still got to go fight for more.
Of course. But I think for me, I want it to be the norm for my kid. Mm. I think we come from a mindset of, like, we can't have. Like, I have because I've made certain sacrifices. And, I've worked hard. I've done all of these things. But I think we get into the danger of perpetuating this cycle that we aren't worthy of these things.
Yep.
So I want my kid to know that this is your norm. Like, it wasn't my norm. It wasn't my father's norm. But this is your norm. And this can become your son's norm, become your kid's norm. Like, this is going to be your everyday. There's no more, like, I can't have this. There's no more, I don't deserve this. Mm-hmm. And this is your everyday because you deserve it. Because I work my ass off and you're going to work your ass off.
Now it's your turn. Now it's your turn to take
that. It's your turn.
Take it. Like, I put the bar. Turn. I raised the bar for you. Now you take it to the next level.
Of course.
Yeah, that's a huge lesson.
I don't want it to be special to him. I want it to be his everyday. Like, I want being able to hop on an airplane going to somewhere simply because you choose to go, not because it's a special thing. Simply because you choose to go, you want to go. I want that to be his norm.
You know, that's a
vacation.
That's crazy.
Vacation,
man.
Shouldn't be like this is a special thing that no one gets to do. This is vacation should be afforded everyone.
You know, it's
like the ability to
it should
take,
be there already.
Take time for yourself.
Yeah, it should be there.
It should be the norm. Of course.
You know, it's incredible that we're talking about this, because just last week I was talking about something with another dad, and we were talking about exposure. Right. And the other dad told me something in the realm of exposure. And I came back and I told him, man, like, I believe in exposure. And I also believe that we are already exposing our kids to more than usual. right?
Of course.
Like, it's almost like people always say you expose your kids to goods, and then they tell you, you know what? You can't expose them unless you leave New York. Like, for in my instance, people are saying, hey, everybody's leaving New York. Now you could go expose them to something else. And it's like, no, I've been exposing them to something else since birth. Like, this isn't special. Exposing them to something new is common. It's actually feels like a duty.
But there's I mean, New York is one of those cities. Like, there's so much exposure. The exposure isn't necessarily going somewhere else.
Yes, you
know,
exactly.
Exposure is a change in mentality. It's a change in, you know, your everyday norm. And you can go up to the West Side and have a nice dinner and still be exposed in a way that you don't, it's different from your everyday. You know, within New York, in every state, there are different levels of living. Different experiences of living, the different mentalities of living, the different perspectives. You can introduce your kid to a whole new world within a matter of 10 blocks in New York.
Yep, that's true. Because it's just a cultural melting pot. You know, so you're going to find all the different things. And I think that because of that, it's almost like exposure isn't something new. Like, it's already happening. It's already part of us. You know what I mean? Where because we care so much and because we came from somewhere different, every day we're showing them something different, something new, something that benefits them. You know, there's of course the bad days, but most of the times we're trying to show them that is much more than what we have. You know, I love what you were saying. I love what you were saying, where you don't want it to be, this is something special. This is just normal. I love that.
It's normal. I think we have to normalize a good life.
Oh, I love that. I love that.
Oftentimes we've come from situations where the good life is this other life we don't normally get to live. And when we get it, and when we get a taste of it, it's something special. And then when we go back to our everyday, it's like, all right, like, I'm stuck back in this place, but I've had a taste of this, you know, good life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the good life should be normal.
It should be every day.
Should be every day. It's not something outside of ourselves. It's not something outside of our beings.
Yeah. No. How do you encourage your kids to get more? Because, like, for me, you know, coming out of the South Bronx, a lot of my friends will tell me, hey, you know, you invested your money, you're into tech, you know, you're living a great life. Like, you have real estate, all of these good things. What more can your kids need? And to me, it's like, no, I want them to keep doing this, but to do it better than me. Right. How do you keep them knowing that they're good, but they should want more? How do you encourage more without feeling like you're being greedy?
Yeah, I don't encourage more. I encourage happiness. Mm. I encourage my kids to do what's going to make them happy.
And that was the gist of this interview right here. Full circle. So you encourage them to be happy.
What's going to fulfill them? You know, I mean, happiness and more is relative. I mean, like, Bill Gates can want more, but he has enough, you know?
Yeah.
Like, well, I'm comfortable, but I can want more, but is it going to make me a better person? Is it going to fulfill me? As long as you have enough to take care of the things that, you know, society, that, like, you can pay your bills, you can put food on the table, you can put clothes on your back. More is all relative to me.
Yeah, is this extra?
It's extra. You know, we need enough to take care of ourselves. We need enough to pay our bills. We need enough for housing. Like, we need, like, yes, work for those things. But beyond that, you know, what's going to fulfill you as a person? And more could be, like, going to the skate park more times than you can in a week. Like, more for me is, you know, doing something that's going to make you feel better as a person. It's not about material all the time.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. I think I tell that to people all the time, man. Like, happiness isn't materialistic. It's not money. You know, it's a feeling, and you can never buy that feeling.
It is. You know, money is a tool. Money, like, that's right. I just learned this. Well, I've heard it before, but it just clicked with me in a different way this week. Money is it literally is a tool for our happiness.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and it shouldn't be the money, bar. It shouldn't be the gauge of your happiness.
It shouldn't be the bar. I mean, if you want more. Like, obviously, you're going to need more money to get something that's going to fulfill you on a different level. But, I mean, experience, exposure often leads to more happiness than money. And money, you know, thinking about it, money affords us experience. That's all money does for us. It affords us experience, which that experience then makes us happy.
Yeah. And how many people out there got an abundance of money and are just some miserable people?
Exactly.
Where that should tell you that life is way more than just a dollar sign. You know what I mean?
And I teach my kids to chase experience and to deal with themselves and their emotions and how they feel about things more than chasing material things.
Yeah. So when you started doing opera singing, right, and you started getting into the business of opera, I'm sure it was different. You were probably one of the few black people there, right? One of the few minorities there, but you were chasing happiness, fulfillment, right? How did the business of opera question your happiness? Like, was there moments where you looked at it and you said, "What the hell am I doing here?" And how did you overcome that moment? And how do you plan on teaching your kids that sometimes the things that they do, other people just don't rock with?
Right. You know, so I had this experience which really cemented my mentality when it comes to music and performing and business, period. So when I was in conservatory in Philadelphia, I was singing. I mean, first of all, I always sang because I just loved to sing. Like,
it made you feel good. Yeah, it made you feel good.
It made me feel good. I didn't really know anything about the business of singing. And of course, once I got scholarships and people became more invested in my singing, then the stakes got a lot higher. And it wasn't as much fun for me because the consequences of my failure were greater than what I was willing to accept because so many other people had a stake in it. But when I was in conservatory, like I was singing, trying to meet demands of other people. And I got a vocal injury. So your vocal cords are a muscle and you can hurt them just like any other muscle. And I got a vocal injury and I couldn't sing. And I had defined myself as a singer. Like my identity was so tied up in my singing that when I couldn't sing, I didn't know what to do. And
you felt lost.
I felt lost, you know. Yeah. I felt lost and I had to cancel concerts. I had to cancel a few things. And I went to the conservatory and the head of the school was there. And I couldn't talk. So when you have a vocal injury, they recommend you don't talk. You don't move your vocal cords so they can heal properly. Because it's such a fine muscle, you want it to heal in a certain way. So I couldn't utter a sound just to keep my vocal cords from moving. So when I went to the conservatory, the head of the school, you know, he looked at me and, you know, he asked me if I could sing. And I motioned no, I can't sing. Mm-hmm. He's like, "Well, what are you doing here then?" And I was like, I was crushed because I spent every day in the school. Like I work with him. You know, I spent every day in the school training to be an opera singer and trying to, you know, sing for their approval. And he asked me, what am I doing here? And that moment when I couldn't sing, it let me know that, you know, the business is more concerned with the business than me as a person.
They're more concerned about the talent, not the person that brings the talent.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Of course. They're more concerned about the business and the talent, exactly, than me as a person. So I went home and I was crushed in that moment because I realized that I put more value in trying to perform for these people or perform for the business than myself. So ever since that moment, you know, I got back to that point of like, I'm doing this for my own love of the art form and my own fulfillment. And if someone else happens to get enjoyment out of it, great, but I'm not doing it for them.
Mm. So do it for self.
So the way that transmits. Yeah, I'm doing it for myself. I'm doing it for my own love of it. And, you know, I'll always transfer that lesson to my kids. Like if you're not having fun, if it's not feeding you, if it's not feeding your spirit, then it's not for you. You know, take a step away and figure out what's going to feed your spirit in this life. And that's where you go. That's the direction you go into.
Oh, man. I love it, man. I love that answer because I think, especially now with COVID around, a lot of the people that have jobs are mostly city workers, you know, like teachers, sanitation, police officers. And when I was growing up, everybody told me I should become a police officer or become a teacher. And I always told them that's not going to be fun for me.
Right.
And now, even though life has changed a little bit because of this pandemic, I wouldn't have changed it at all. Like, I love what I do. Like, I was a technologist. Mm-hmm. Like, I went and I got my bachelor's and my master's in computer science, and I still chose to go do my own thing. I still chose entrepreneurship. And even though I might have, like, some naysayers in the family, like mother-in-law, father-in-law type of things, I'm always conscious and always telling my son, I'm happy. Like, this was for me. I didn't do this for them. God didn't put me on this earth to make my mother-in-law or any other naysayer happy. He put me on earth for me to be fulfilled. And I'm fulfilling my destiny by being happy. I constantly preach that to him. And sometimes it even feels a little corny, right? Like, it feels like, man, you're always this holier than thou. Yo, go do your thing, like, super positive. But I have to do that. Because if not, the world will eat him up and make him do things he don't want to do.
He'll understand it at some point. When he's working in a job that he hates. No, but
It'll click. When
I was 16, I worked in a department store in the mall. It was like one of these, I think it was like Last Stop or something like that, in a mall in D.C. And I was on break from college, and I was doing these things that were just feeding my spirit. You know, I was so happy and I was so full, but I needed money. Like, I was, you know, home for summer. So I took a job in this store, and like the first day, like, I was standing around, like, pretending to fold clothes. I was pretending to work. I was pretending to be busy. Man, at the end of that day, I was like, yeah, like, this isn't for me. Like, you don't even have to pay me. Like, thank you for the experience of letting me know that this is not the life I want to live. I'm done.
I quit.
After day one, you know?
He said, screw the money, man. I'm good.
Yeah, I'm good. Like, I mean, it's not like the money that I would have made today wasn't even enough. You know, it wouldn't, you know, pay for the experience of knowing that I never want to do this again. So go ahead, keep it. Thank you. I'm happy to fold your clothes for 10 hours a day.
I love it. Kenneth, I don't want to take up too much of your time, bro, but this has been incredible. Like, when I met you at Dad 2.0 Summit, I looked at you and I said, damn, an opera singer, man. Like, this dude got to have some stories, man, because I came from a world that it wasn't the norm for me to be a computer scientist.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Computer scientist, bro. Come on. Like, come become a street pharmacist with us. You know, and it's incredible to hear that. You know, I don't like to give people too much intros or bios about my speakers, because I feel that dads could be dads no matter where or where in life they're at, in the position in life or profession. But being able to speak to you was eye-opening, bro. It made me feel like I was talking to one of my friends from back in the hood.
When you get it. Yeah, when you get it, man, you get it.
That's incredible.
It's been a pleasure, man.
I appreciate you, man, because I'm going to be honest, man. I thought you were going to hit me with some stuck-up stuff, bro. I thought you were gonna come in here and be like, "Nah, man, I'm the man, man. Like, I will out-sing you and take your girl from you."
Nah, man. It's funny because, you know, being an opera singer, I mean, you know, being a black opera singer, there's a few of us who are in the field and you know, have similar experiences, you know. But when I go into the opera world, I have to. It's a different lifestyle. It's a different approach, different perspective that I have to take.
Yeah.
I have to, you know, live both of those worlds.
And represent.
But it's good to be able to talk about life, real life, with someone who gets it and someone who understands. You know?
Yeah, man, we here, man. We here, and we're doing the best for our kids, man. What's the best way for people to contact you? And by the way, next time you come to New York City, if you're performing, I will be there. And don't worry, you don't got to hook me up with tickets. It might smell funny in my corner, but we'll be fine.
Everything got canceled.
It might smell funny in my corner, but we'll be good, all right? We won't embarrass
I'll
you.
I'll know where you are.
Yeah, but what's the quickest way for people to reach you? What's the best way?
I mean, I guess what? Instagram? I think it's K Kellogg.
Yep. I'll put it in the show notes.
I'm on Facebook. Yeah, I'm on Facebook. I have a Twitter account. I don't really do it that much.
Yeah. Twitter's the best. I love Twitter.
Twitter is the best.
Yeah. Just for communication.
For some reason, I understand the importance of social media. But I mostly do it, you know, for career, for stuff like this. You know, I try to live. Funny, my life is so much in the practice room and singing and you're connecting with people. It's funny, during these COVID times, you know, we have to do all of our music on online and digital. It feels like a different world, man.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, those are my social media handles. Like, I'm active, but not as active.
You're living life.
The TikTok craze, yeah.
You're living life, man. You're living life, and that's all we could ask for. You're living life. You're showing your kids how to live life.
If we can't
contact you, at least we know you're doing the right thing, man. And that's all that matters. You're putting on for us.
You're not just putting on for your family.
You're putting on for us.
You can contact me. I'm there. But yeah.
Yeah, you represent for
You'll
dads
never catch
that look
me
like
doing
us.
A TikTok.
Oh, you're not going to stage it? You're not going to stage no dances, switching clothes?
Nah, man.
Wearing your wife's clothes?
Definitely not.
Now, we leave that to the other dads, the ones that are, that are worried about making an impact in the comedy world.
Of course. But
Kenneth, thank you so much, man. I really, really appreciate this. You know, to the community, you can never go wrong doing you, and that's a huge lesson for our kids. Their likes and wants might not be like everyone else's, but it's still special. Continue to support them, because a child that's supported at home can do anything they choose in life, and that's a fact. Kenneth just taught us that. Fatherhood is lit.